symbolism. The seventh station was the house of building life on earth. There Marduk took the title God of the House of Resting. It is our contention that the seven stations in the procession of Marduk represented the space trip of the Nephilim from their planet to earth. Taking into consideration that their own planet and their target Earth were both in continuous motion, the Nephilim had to aim their craft not at where Earth was at launch time, but where it would be at arrival time. One can safely assume that the Nephilim worked out their trajectories very much as modern scientists mapped the missions to the moon and other planets. Based on complex technical data, as well as hints in Mesopotamian texts, it appears that the Nephilim adopted for their Earth missions the same approach NASA adopted for the moon missions. When the principal spaceship neared the Earth, it went into orbit around Earth without actually landing. Instead, a smaller craft was released from the mothership and performed the actual landing. As difficult as accurate landings were, the departures from Earth must have been even trickier. The landing craft had to rejoin its mothership, which then had to fire up its engines and accelerate to extremely high speeds, for it had to catch up with the 12th planet, which by then was passing its perigee between Mars and Jupiter at its top orbital speed. Suitable terrain, guidance from Earth, and perfect coordination with the home planet were required for successful arrivals, landings, takeoffs, and departures from Earth. As we shall see, the Nephilim met all of these requirements. The story of the first settlement of Earth by intelligent beings is a breathtaking saga no less inspiring than the discovery of America or the circumnavigation of Earth. The Epic of Creation informs us that the gods came to Earth following a deliberate decision by their leader. Marduk explained his purpose. When from the heavens, for assembly you shall descend, there shall be a rest place for the night. To receive you all, I will name it Babylon, the gateway to the gods. Earth was thus not merely the object of visit or quick exploratory stay. It was to be a permanent home away from home. As the Nephilim searched for an additional home, Earth must have struck them favorably. Its blue hues indicated it had life-sustaining water and air. Its browns disclosed firm lands, its greens vegetation, and the basis for animal life. Yet when the Nephilim finally voyaged to Earth, it must have looked somewhat different from the way it does to our astronauts today. For when the Nephilim first came to Earth, Earth was in the midst of an ice age, a glacial period that was one of the icing and de-icing phases of Earth's climate. Arriving on Earth amid such climatic and geographic conditions, where were the Nephilim to set up their first abode? They searched, no doubt, for a place with a relatively temperate climate, where simple shelters would suffice. They must also have searched for water for drinking, washing, and industrial purposes, as well as to sustain the plant and animal life needed for food. Rivers would both facilitate the irrigation of large tracts of land and provide a convenient means of transportation. The attention of the Nephilim, as we now know, focused on three major river systems and their plains: the Nile, the Indus, and the Tigris-Euphrates. Each of these river basins were suitable for early colonizations. Each, in time, became the center of an ancient civilization. The Book of Genesis describes God's abode on Earth, Eden, as a place of temperate climate, warm yet breezy. It was a place of good soil, lending itself to agriculture and horticulture. It was a place that drew its waters from a network of four rivers, and the name of the third river was Tigris. It was one which flowed toward the east of Assyria, and the fourth was the Euphrates. The selection of Mesopotamia as the home on Earth was probably motivated by at least one other important consideration. Though the Nephilim in time established a spaceport on dry land, some evidence suggests that at least initially they landed by splashing down into the sea in a hermetically sealed capsule. If this was the landing method, Mesopotamia offered proximity to two seas, the Indian Ocean to the south and the Mediterranean to the west. Early Sumerian depictions frequently show massive structures built in earliest times of reeds and wood, standing in fields among grazing cattle. The current assumption that these were the stables for cattle is contradicted by the pillars that are invariably shown protruding from the roofs of such structures. The pillars' purpose was to support pairs of rings. Were the pairs of rings radar emitters placed in the fields to guide the incoming shuttlecraft? Were the eye-like pillars scanning devices the all-seeing eyes of the gods of which many texts have spoken? The flat plane necessitated, it seems, the artificial raising of platforms on which the space-related equipment was to be placed. Text and depictions leave no doubt that the structures range from the earliest field huts to the later staged platforms, reached by stairways and sloped ramps that led from a broad lower stage to a narrower upper one. At the top, an actual residence for the god was built, surrounded by a flat-walled courtyard to house his bird and weapons. Even scholars who have approached the subject without our space interpretation could not escape the conclusion that the ziggurats had some purpose other than to make the god's abode a high-rise building. Samuel N. Kramer summed up the scholastic consensus. The ziggurat, the stage tower, which became the hallmark of Mesopotamian temple architecture, was intended to serve as a connecting link, both real and symbolic, between the gods in heaven and the mortals on earth. We have shown, however, that the true function of these structures was to connect the gods of heaven with the gods, not the mortals, on earth. The Sumerian text explains that at the very early stage of the arrival of the gods on earth, a separation of power was agreed upon. Anu was to stay in the heavens and rule over the 12th planet, Enlil was to command the lands, and Enki was to be put in charge of the Abzu. Now, it was a distant land with flowing waters, bursting with riches, a place that lay beyond a sea. Literally, the term Abzu meant the primeval deep source. According to Sumerian grammatical rules, the term could also be written Zuab without changing its meaning. The latter spelling enables identification of its parallel in the Semitic language, for Zuab means precious metal, specifically gold. The pictographic signs employed as Sumer's first writing reveal great familiarity not only with diverse metallurgical processes, but also with the fact that the sources of the metals were mines dug down into the earth. The terms for copper, bronze, and gold, or refined, were all variants of a mine shaft. A lively metals trade existed in the very beginnings of civilization, the result of knowledge bequeathed to mankind by the gods, who, the texts state, had engaged in mining and metallurgy long before man's appearance. The Old Testament recognized the land of Ophir, which is probably somewhere in Africa, as a source of gold in antiquity. Many biblical scholars have suggested Ophir should be identified with the former Rhodesia, now called Zimbabwe. Z. Herman brought together evidence showing that the Egyptians obtained various minerals from Zimbabwe in earliest times. In fact, scientists have suggested that southern Africa could well have been in the forefront of technological invention and innovation during much of the period subsequent to 100,000 B.C. Commenting on the discoveries, Dr. Kenneth Oakley, former head anthropologist of the Natural History Museum in London, saw quite a different significance to the finds. It throws important light on the origins of man. It's now possible that southern Africa was the evolutionary home of man, the birthplace of Homo sapiens. As we shall show, it was indeed there that modern man appeared on Earth through a chain of events triggered by the gods' search for metals. Man's infatuation with gold is traceable to the beginnings of his civilization and religion, to his contacts with the ancient gods. The gods of Sumer required that they be served food from golden trays, water and wine from golden vessels, and they be clad in golden garments. The Nephilim, it appears, came to earth for gold and its related metals. They may have also come for another rare metal, such as platinum, which can power fuel cells in an extraordinary manner. The ancient texts describe the Anunnaki as the rank-and-file gods who had been involved in the settlement of Earth, the gods who performed the task. The Babylonian epic of creation credited Marduk with giving the Anunnaki their assignments. One text relates how Marduk rushed to his father Ea to report the loss of a spacecraft carrying the Anunnaki, who are 50, as it passed near Saturn. Could it be that 50 was the number of Nephilim in each landing party? As the visits to Earth became regular, more Nephilim would arrive, and the number who stayed to colonize Earth grew from the initial landing party of 50 to the 600 who on Earth settled. How did the Nephilim expect to achieve their mission to mine on Earth its desired minerals and ship the ingots back to the 12th planet with such a small number of hands? The story begins in the time when only the gods lived on Earth. When the gods, like men, bore the work and suffered the toil, The toil of the gods was great, the work was heavy, the distress was much. Seven cities were established, and the text refers to seven Anunnaki who were city commanders. Discipline must have been strict, for the text tells us the seven great Anunnaki were making the lesser gods suffer the work. For a long time the Anunnaki suffered the toil, and then they cried, "No more!" The occasion for the mutiny appears to have been a visit by Enlil to the mining area. The Anunnaki stood together. "Every single one of us gods has war declared. Excessive toil has killed us. Our work was heavy, the distress much." When Enlil heard the report of these grievances, his tears flowed. Ea had a solution to offer. Let a primitive worker be created. The suggestion was readily accepted. Unanimously, the gods voted to create the worker. "Man shall be his name," they said. A mutiny of the gods had led to the creation of man.